Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and we're going to start the next chapter, which is 14. It's still a cardiovascular chapter, and this is not a terribly long chapter, but nonetheless, it's going to take me two lectures to get through it, and you'll understand some things in the first lecture pretty well, but you won't understand everything in the first lecture until after the second lecture. So that means you got to go over it. I won't lecture one twice. You just have to make sure that you go over it and read the material and study it, okay? It's just one of those things where you have to know everything all at once, and you just can't. So you just got to keep an open mind as to what we're doing. So we're going to talk about cardiac output, the effects of blood volume on the cardiovascular system, how that influences blood pressure, things that influence blood flow. Maybe you've already done some experiments in lab with blood flow. You've worked with Poiseuille's equation in lab. And then we'll talk about blood pressure. And then after you know something about blood pressure, then you got to go back to the first step and relearn something about the heart. Okay, that's just kind of the way it goes. But you got plenty of study questions to work with to help you synthesize the information. All right, so I'm going to turn just a couple of these lights down, I think. Oh, I can't turn any more down. Okay, so we're going to talk about cardiac output, and cardiac output is the amount of blood that the heart pumps per a certain unit of time, and we're just going to pick what's a convenient period of time. Let's say a semester. No, that's too long. We're going to do a minute, right? And so cardiac output is a volume per minute. So what's a good units to use in medicine? How do we measure stuff in medicine? Liters or milliliters, so let's use milliliters, right? So cardiac output is in the units of milliliters per minute, all right? So don't forget, milliliters is a volume. A milliliter is the same thing as a cubic centimeter if you were going to measure it out, okay? So cardiac output is the volume of blood that's pumped per minute by each ventricle, and each ventricle really should have the same cardiac output over a relatively short period of time, like maybe a minute or so. All right, so if the left ventricle is going to pump a lot more blood than the right ventricle, that means then that blood would back up someplace in the circulation because the right ventricle and left ventricle are just two pumps that are in series. They're connected in a big loop. All right, and so if they're not pumping the same amount, you don't have the same flow through the loop, that means it's going to collect someplace in that loop. And that just can't happen. So the right side of the heart has to be matched up or balanced with the left side of the heart. Okay, some more definitions. The stroke volume is the amount of blood that's pumped by the ventricle every time it beats. All right, so that's kind of important because when the heart contracts, it doesn't pump out 100% of the blood. There's always some left over in the ventricle after contraction, but the amount that gets pushed into an artery, that's what we call the stroke volume. And how do we measure volumes? That is a milliliter, right? So that's a milliliter. All right, so this is how we would calculate cardiac output. Cardiac output is going to be equal to the stroke volume. So what's a stroke? What's the units of stroke volume? It's a volume, so it's what? Milliliters for what kind of time? Every time the heart beats, right? So it's milliliters per beat. And we got to, in order to figure out the cardiac output, we got to multiply by some kind of time unit. And so we just measure the heart rate and what are the dimensions of heart rate? It would be, for instance, beats per minute. Okay, so that's the dimensions right here and right here. Now, how can you simplify these dimensional units, these dimensions? The beats cancel out, and what are you left with? Milliliters per minute, and what does that correspond to? Cardiac output, just like it should. So in order to know cardiac output, you have to know at least the heart rate and the stroke volume. All right, the total blood volume is about 5.5 liters, and your heart pumps about 5 liters a minute. All right, so that's about one circulation time. Okay. Now, the heart can be adjusted by, or the cardiac output can be adjusted by these two different factors right here. All right, so one is a rate, and the other is kind of a measure of the strength of contraction. All right, so the strength of contraction is what we call inotropy of the heart. All right, that's strength of contraction. That's an inotropic event. But heart rate is more what we call a chronotropy. So how the heart is working is due to both the strength of contraction and the rate at which it contracts. All right, so we want to be able to separate the workings of the heart down into inotropic events and chronotropic events. All right, and without neuronal influences, the heart is kind of an interesting and strange organ because it's going to contract on its own. It's what we call autorhythmic, right? It's autorhythmic, so the heart is going to beat on its own. But what the nervous innervation does is that it might influence the heart rate. It can speed it up or slow it down, and it will also influence the force of contraction. So we're going to look at the innervation of the heart. Okay, so normally, well, what are the two divisions of nerves that go to the heart? Or what's one? What is the nervous system that innervates the heart? What do we call that? It's the autonomic nervous system. And what are the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system? It's just sympathetic and parasympathetic, right? Parasympathetic slows it down. All right, so normally sympathetic and parasympathetic activity influences heart rate. We call that a chronotropic effect. And where does the heart receive information to contract? It's a part of the heart. It's an autorhythmic part of the heart. The SA node is the pacemaker of the heart, and you know it's autorhythmic. You know what the action potential looks like in a nodal cell from the last test. So sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves influence how the sinoatrial node depolarizes, how that pacemaker potential, right, or it influences the slope of that pacemaker potential. All right, so autonomic innervation of the SA node is the main controller of heart rate. All right, sympathetic and parasympathetic nerve fibers modify the rate of spontaneous depolarization. So here we have a couple figures. Here we have just a baseline control view of depolarization. Now, does this action potential here look like an action potential from a nodal cell or from a myocardial cell? A contractile cell or a conductive cell? A part of the heart that specialized for conduction or is specialized for contraction? And how would you know? Because an action potential coming from a myocardial cell that is specialized for contraction has that big plateau phase in it, right? So that the heart can't go into tetanus, right? So I don't see a big plateau phase right here. So hence, this is a nodal cell. And indeed, this is a graph of membrane potential versus time of the SA node or a cell in the SA node. All right, and what can you tell me about resting membrane potential in these kinds of cells? Is it ever at rest? It's never constant. It's really not at rest. It is, but it is slowly depolarizing. Can you remember the kinds of channels that are there that allow that spontaneous depolarization? That's it. The HCN channel. Okay, the HCN channel. And so this area right here, or this line that is drifting up toward threshold, that's what we call a pacemaker potential. This is sort of coming back to you a little bit, right? The pacemaker potential. And when the pacemaker potential reaches threshold, what happens? Yeah, then it opens up voltage-gated channels, and it depolarizes and forms an action potential. And this action potential can sweep over the whole myocardium, because the myocardium is a syncytium. All the cells are connected to each other electrically. What membrane component allows all the cells to communicate with each other electrically within the myocardium? It's the gap junctions, exactly right. Okay. All right. So this is under baseline conditions, but with increasing sympathetic tone, release of norepinephrine on the SA node, look what happens to the slope of the pacemaker potential. It gets much steeper, right? So what does that mean? That means that it reaches threshold much more quickly. And as a result, right, that's going to stimulate depolarization, which is going to sweep over the whole cell and cause a contraction. And what about the next contraction? It happens much more rapidly. So with sympathetic stimulation or increasing sympathetic tone on the heart, that increases the heart rate because it increases the slope of the pacemaker potential. That's the best way to say it. Okay. Now, why does that happen? All right, because that opens the HCN channels, and that just allows more sodium to enter the cell. All right, acetylcholine, on the other hand, which is what? The postganglionic neurotransmitter of the parasympathetic nervous system, when it's released on the SA node, that is going to open potassium channels, and that's going to counteract the effect of that sodium influx from the HCN channels, so that is going to decrease the slope of the pacemaker potential. That means it's going to take longer to reach threshold, which then means what? That each subsequent depolarization is going to be farther and farther away in time, and so the heart rate slows down. All right, so you should be able to picture how that works pretty easily. Anybody have a question on that? All right, so how norepinephrine and acetylcholine influence the pacemaker potential. That's going to adjust the heart rate, and then, of course, you should know where that is. What part of the heart is that happening at? That's the SA node, right? That's right on the SA node, which is on the atrium. Okay. So that adjusts the chronotropy of the heart, but we still want to know something about adjusting the inotropy of the heart, right? So what have we just talked about? That pacemaker potential and how it influences heart rate. Does adjusting the pacemaker potential have anything to do with the stroke volume? You know what? It doesn't. It's completely independent. So there has to be other things that adjust the stroke volume of the heart or the contractility of the heart. And that is mostly done by the cardiac control center. I like to call it the cardioregulatory center. And can you remember where the cardiac control center is, or the cardioregulatory center is, from anatomy? That's in the medulla oblongata, right? That's part of the control center there. It also can control the vessel diameter. There's a vasomotor center in the medulla oblongata, right? And so that coordinates autonomic output. So sympathetic endings from the cardiac control center go to the atria, the muscles of the atria and the ventricles, and they can cause an increased strength of contraction. And when the heart contracts more strongly, right, even though maybe we're holding the heart rate constant, guess what happens to stroke volume? When the heart beats more vigorously, there's a larger stroke volume. Okay? All right, so these two events work together. So cardiac output is related to stroke volume. How would you talk about that relationship between cardiac output and stroke volume? Is directly related, or would you say inversely related? Directly related. So as stroke volume increases, what happens to cardiac output? It increases. How is heart rate related to cardiac output? Directly related, right? It's a nice simple relationship. So if heart rate goes up, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up. And if both stroke volume and heart rate go up, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up in a bigger way, right? Because you multiply those two effects together. All right, so here's a pretty interesting table that you should spend some time looking at. I don't think I'm going to go over this too much. Okay. And here we see different regions of the heart, like the SA node and the AB node. We have atrial muscle, we have ventricular muscle, and then, of course, we have the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system, namely sympathetic and parasympathetic. Notice that nerves from the sympathetic nervous system, is anybody being disturbed by conversations in the back of the room? You might, please, just keep it down, okay? Because I know this is a hard chapter. Okay, sympathetic innervation goes to all these places on the heart, the SA node, AB node. This is going to adjust the rate of contraction, but it also goes to atrial muscle and ventricular muscle. This is going to affect stroke volume. But notice that the parasympathetic nervous system only goes where? Only goes to the SA node and AV node. So parasympathetic stimulation can only adjust what? Can it adjust both the inotropy and chronotropy of the heart? No, it can only adjust the chronotropy of the heart. So that is kind of interesting to see that on this slide right here. So parasympathetic stimulation has no effect on inotropy of the heart. Can't increase or decrease the force of contraction or adjust stroke volume. It can influence cardiac output. How can parasympathetic stimulation influence cardiac output? Because it can influence heart rate only. All right? And if it slows the heart rate down, what happens to cardiac output? It goes down as well, right? Because it's directly related. So that's the effect of parasympathetic stimulation on the heart. It can only adjust the rate of contraction, but not the force of contraction. All right, so let's pay attention a little bit more to stroke volume, right, which is related to inotropy of the heart. All right, it's determined by three variables. The end diastolic volume. Now, what volume is that? Is that the big one or little one? That's the big one. When does it happen? At the end of diastole, and that's why we call it the end diastolic volume. Now, what's happening during diastole? What's happening to the heart? It's filling with blood, and so it's stretching. The heart is getting bigger as it fills with blood, right? It fills during diastole. This is the largest volume because right at the end of diastole, the heart starts to contract, and then blood is going to be ejected from the heart. Another thing that determines stroke volume is the resistance that the heart faces in pumping blood into blood vessels. So we call that the total peripheral resistance. That's impedance to blood flow through arteries. All right, and I'll show you how this relates to the cardiovascular system pretty much in the next lecture. All right, but this is going to influence stroke volume. You know a little bit about this from your lab work. Remember Poiseuille's equation when you worked with that in lab? A little bit, maybe. How did you work with Poiseuille's equation? You had these long glass tubes, remember? And you'd laid them out on the table, and sometimes you used a tube with a really big diameter, maybe not quite that big, and then a really tiny diameter, and you measured the amount of flow with the same pressure through these tubes. And then you did something else. Instead of using one tube, you actually put two tubes together. Okay, what happened to flow when you put two tubes together? Did it increase or decrease the flow? It decreased the flow because what happened was that the resistance went up, okay, when you put those two tubes together. So resistance does change how blood flows through the cardiovascular system. How else could you increase, so anyway, you increase resistance by making the tube longer. If you make the tube shorter, what happens to resistance? It goes down, right? And I think you should be able to relate that to the systemic circulation and the pulmonary circulation, because which one is longer? Is systemic longer or pulmonary circulation longer? The systemic is a lot longer. So guess what side of the heart has to work a lot harder, because since the systemic circulation is a lot longer, the resistance is a lot higher. So in order to move blood through the systemic circulation, what side of the heart has to work a lot harder? It's the left side, and you can see that when you do a dissection. It's hypertrophied, and I think last time I showed you a slide of the pressure difference. The normal blood pressure in the systemic circulation is about 120 over 80. Pulmonary circulation is just kind of a measly 20-something, maybe 25 over 12 or 10, something like that. The pressure is a lot less. Okay, so this resistance plays an important role. All right, and then the last thing is myocardial contractility. That's just the strength of ventricular contraction, how vigorously the heart contracts. All right, so what autonomic nervous system can control contractility? What division of the autonomic nervous system? Okay, and don't forget, contractility is what we call the inotropy of the heart. That is what? Only the sympathetic nervous system, right? Not the parasympathetic nervous system. All right, so we're interested in all of these effects right here. Oh, what's another way that you could increase resistance to flow? Okay. It was in that Poiseuille's equation that you worked with in lab, but you didn't alter this one, but I think maybe you talked about it. You measured the length and the diameter or the radius of a vessel, and then there was one other parameter, and this other parameter your body doesn't really adjust very much. Okay, yeah, the pressure is real important. Okay, and what I was looking for is viscosity. That's right. So if you increase viscosity instead of like a fluid, a liquid like water, If you put molasses in a tube, is that going to impede the flow or speed up the flow? That's going to slow it down. Okay? So those are some things that affect resistance. I'll talk about those more next time. All right, so how can we regulate stroke volume? Well, the end diastolic volume is the workload that's placed on the heart. Sometimes we call that the preload. All right, so this is the work that's placed on the heart prior to contraction. And the stroke volume is directly related to preload and contractility. All right, so I'll have to show you how this works. The next slide will describe this to you, why that is. All right, so the end diastolic volume, right, is going to determine the stroke volume of the heart. The strength of contraction varies directly with the end diastolic volume, and I'll give you a nice molecular way for you to picture that. All right, the total peripheral resistance of all the blood vessels in your body are what we call the afterload. That's the force that impedes ejection from the ventricle. So we call that the afterload, right? So if there's a high pressure in an artery, the ventricle has to work harder to push blood into that high pressure artery. Okay. Now there's something maybe I didn't tell you, but how will a fluid flow? Why will a fluid flow from one point to another? And a fluid could be a gas that's in our atmosphere or a liquid that's in our body like blood. How is fluid going to flow? Okay, just like osmosis or diffusion, particles will move from high concentration to low. There's got to be a concentration difference, right? Fluid will flow from one place to another, but there's got to be a pressure difference. There's got to be a high pressure, and fluid will flow to a lower pressure. So there's got to be a change in pressure. Okay. Okay, here is another real important consideration, and that is the ejection fraction. The ejection fraction is the amount of blood that's pumped out of the ventricle, but it's normalized by how big the ventricle is when it starts to contract, right? So it's a percentage of the volume of the blood that's pumped out of the heart. So if the heart beats very weakly, okay, and it pumps out half the blood, then the ejection fraction would be 50%. Right, so the way we calculate that is that we look at the measure of the stroke volume, the amount of blood that's pumped out of the ventricle, and then we have to measure the end diastolic volume. So we divide systolic volume by end diastolic volume, and notice normally it's about 60%. So how much blood is left in the heart when the normal heart contracts after systole? Yeah, only about 40%. Or 40% is left in the ventricle after contraction. Okay, so it's nowhere near 50%. This is really important because we like to look at this number. If somebody has cardiovascular disease and this number starts to decline, all right, then we would want to do some kind of intervention for that patient very quickly, because once it gets down to maybe 30% or 35%, maybe even 40%, then there are irreversible changes that happen in the heart, and after that point, no matter what we do, the heart is never going to come back the way it was. Right, so this is a very important indication of prognosis of how a patient will recover, but it might also determine timing for surgery or valve replacement or something like that. Okay, what does prognosis mean? I use that term. I'm not sure you know what prognosis means. Diagnosis means what? When you come up with a reason why somebody has a disease, right, or has some kind of clinical symptoms. Right, and then since you have a diagnosis, you can formulate a treatment, right, and get the patient better. And what does prognosis mean? Prognosis means that as a result of the treatment, what are the likely outcomes that the patient will experience, right? Will they have a full recovery or 50% recovery or 30% recovery, right? So the lower this ejection fraction is, the worse the prognosis is. So you can't fool around too much when somebody's ejection fraction is decreasing. Okay. All right, so here's a very important law of the heart that adjusts the stroke volume or helps adjust the inotropy of the heart, and that participates, of course, in cardiac output right here. This is the Frank-Starling law of the heart. And let's take a look at the stroke volume plotted against the end diastolic volume. All right, so what is stroke volume again? That's just the amount of blood that the ventricle pumps out every time it contracts, just the volume, okay? And what's the end diastolic volume? That's just the volume of the ventricle as it expands, as it's filling up with blood. Okay. So another way of thinking of end diastolic volume is, what's happening to the ventricle as it fills up? It stretches, right? It actually stretches when it fills up with blood. So this you could think of as the amount of stretch of the myocardium as it's filling up with blood. Now, how is the stroke volume related to the stretch of the heart or the end diastolic volume? All right, the stroke volume, is it constant as the end diastolic volume changes? All right, if it was constant, what kind of line would we see? Just a flat line. It would just be a flat line. But what are these lines? What are these? All these lines right here, what do they look like? Okay, yeah, what this shows you is that the stroke volume is directly related to end diastolic volume. So as the end diastolic volume increases, right, so if we start here with a very low end diastolic volume, we have a low stroke volume. But as the end diastolic volume increases, so does the stroke volume. All right, so it increases. So the force of contraction increases as the heart stretches out. All right, and indeed, if we look at different cases of increasing sympathetic tone or sympathetic activity on the heart, because don't forget the sympathetic nervous system goes to the ventricular myocardium, right? As sympathetic activity increases, what can you tell me about stroke volume even at a constant end diastolic volume? So if we compare this value with this value and this one, what happens to the heart? It gets stronger and stronger and stronger as sympathetic activity increases, right? So that's the second thing that you should see on this slide. All right, so as the heart fills with more blood, it gets stronger because of this line right here, right? Do you see that? And as the sympathetic activity increases, it even gets stronger still. Okay, so this property of the heart is what we call intrinsic regulation of the heart, because this doesn't have anything to do, for instance, this line right here is irrespective of any kind of innervation on the heart. All right, without parasympathetic stimulation or sympathetic stimulation, as we increase the stretch of the heart, okay, the heart contracts with more force. And that's really good, because as more blood is presented to the heart, as more venous blood is returned to the heart, guess how the heart responds? More efficiently, and it contracts with more vigor to pump that blood that's given to it to pump. So this is a very good thing. All right, so the other thing, don't forget about this intrinsic property of the heart. What would extrinsic mean? Extrinsic regulation would mean that it means that some other kinds of organs or control mechanisms from outside the heart is going to regulate how it works. All right, so what might be a good example of extrinsic regulation on the heart? What's something outside the heart that can control something on the heart, either heart rate or contractility? Like, for instance, the medulla oblongata, the cardiac control center, right, can affect the heart. That would be an extrinsic mechanism. But this Frank-Starling law is just an intrinsic property of the heart. Even without innervation or influence from anything outside the heart, it still adjusts its contractility depending on how much it stretches. All right, so how can we explain that? And you should probably be able to maybe even come up with this on your own, but here's a nice graph that's in your textbook. Here is a plot of tension that's developed, and let's just look at one heart cell, one contractile cell inside the heart, and it's going to contract and it's going to produce some tension, and let's look at a twitch versus time, okay? And we have four different twitches right here, and these four different twitches depends on the end diastolic volume. A is the smallest and B is the largest end diastolic volume, or you could think of end diastolic volume as what, the amount of stretch, how much we're stretching the myocardium. So what are some of the contractile proteins that you have inside the heart? How do you think of contraction in the heart? Where should your mind automatically zoom into? What's the structural and functional unit of contraction inside heart muscle? Is a sarcomere, right? The sarcomere. And what kind of proteins do you have in a sarcomere? You got the myosin and the actin, and which one of those actually shorten? Okay, I still can't trick you? Okay, that's good. None of them shorten. How would you explain shortening of a sarcomere? Since actin and myosin don't contract, they do what? They just slide over each other, right? Back. They slide over each other for contraction, and during relaxation, they slide back. All right, so what we have plotted over here on the far right-hand side of the slide, of course, the endpoints of a sarcomere are what we call the Z-discs, and the actin's attached to the Z-discs. And this corresponds to the tension that's developed in trace A right over here. Now, when you look at this sarcomere right here, since it's not stretched out, look at the overlap of actin and myosin, and look how the myosin is almost butting up against the Z-line. So can this sarcomere shorten very much? Because the actin and myosin can't slide over each other, right? Because the sarcomere has not been stretched out, which means what? The end diastolic volume is very, very low. So this myocyte can contract only very weakly because the actin and myosin filaments can't slide over each other. Right? So how can we improve the force of contraction? We can stretch out that sarcomere. We could increase the end diastolic volume of the heart, stretch the heart out a little bit. So here we have a sarcomere that's just sort of stretched out, but now, right, there's still room for these actin and myosin filaments to slide over each other, and it's going to produce more force. And if we stretch the heart out even a little bit more, look what happens to the force of contraction. It goes up because now we can get a lot of sliding past these actin and myosin filaments. And when we look at an optimal case right here, the case D, right, we still have a lot of cross-bridge overlap with actin, right? But now the sarcomere is stretched out very, very nicely so that there can be a maximal amount of sliding of the myofilaments. And that is going to increase the tension or maximize the tension that can be developed by the sarcomeres inside cardiac muscle. All right, so what we're looking at here are different degrees of end diastolic volume, and you can relate that to overlap of actin and myosin, how it's going to produce different levels of contraction, all right, or heart vigor when the heart does contract. All right, who's got a question on that? So here's a nice molecular model that you should have in your mind that explains what the relationship of contractility of the heart or stroke volume versus what different end diastolic volumes or stretch of the heart cells. So that plays a pretty important role on how, as a matter of fact, I want to leave that on the board for just a second. All right, if we're going to really draw out the full Frank Starling curve, right, which is just a property, intrinsic property of the heart because it only has to do with what? Overlap of actin and myosin filaments. All right, so let's maybe draw a nice plot over here. So this is what? Contractility. Contractility. Okay, sorry about that. Maybe we could call this stroke volume, and then over here is going to be stretch of the heart. How can we measure stretch of the myocardium? The end diastolic volume, right, as it stretches out. All right, so what we saw was this curve right here. We saw as end diastolic volume gets big, so does contractility of the heart because you have a more optimal overlap of actin and myosin. But you know what? Every once in a while, sometimes we stretch the heart out too much. And what's going to happen to contractility when the heart gets stretched out too much? All right, so you got overlap of actin and myosin. What happens if you stretch the heart out so much that now you don't have any overlap of actin and myosin? What's going to happen? There's no cross bridges that can form. So the heart won't generate any tension as well. So the Frank Starling curve really has an ascending limb and a descending limb right here. Now, how would a normal person get into this descending limb pathologically? Okay, yeah. For instance, if you're riding your bicycle home from work or in your car or motorcycle and you get into a really bad accident and you lacerate a femoral artery or a subclavian or something, what's going to happen to blood? Instead of being in your circulatory system, right, it's just going to run right out of your body. What happens to your blood volume as a result of that? Right, it starts to plummet, and as the blood is running out on the ground, how much blood is going back to your heart? Not very much. So if you don't have a lot of blood or normal amount of blood going back to the heart, All right, what can you tell me about the end diastolic volume? It starts to go down and go down and go down. So end diastolic volume goes this way. What happens to the function of the heart because of this intrinsic property of the heart? It goes down, down, down as you lose more and more blood. Okay, so during that time when you're in that accident and you start to hemorrhage, that's the time where you don't want your heart to get weaker and weaker and weaker. But guess what? It does when that happens. All right, that's when you don't want the cardiac output to go down. All right, so this descending limb right here could be due to hemorrhage. And even on the way to the hospital, what would a paramedic do to bring your cardiac function back, to help bring your cardiac function back? They can't give you blood. They can't transfuse you. Maybe some can, but typically no. Because before you get a transfusion, what do you need? Yeah, you need a cross match. You need blood typing and cross match. They just can't, you know, fill you up with blood, because if they put the wrong kind of blood in, that will kill you, right, almost right away. All right, but what can they help you with? They can put in an IV and they can give you fluids, right? They can give you saline, normal saline, so it doesn't hemolyze any of your blood cells. And as they give you saline on the way to the hospital, what happens to your blood volume? Even though it doesn't increase the amount of red blood cells, it just increases the volume, so you have that saline going back to the heart. What is the effect of that saline on your heart? It stretches the heart out, that increases the end diastolic volume, and what does that do to the strength of contraction of the heart? It gets stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger, right? And that possibly could save your life and prevent you even maybe, well, it would prevent you from going into shock, right? Just by giving you fluids. Brings your heart contractility back because of that Frank Starling law. Okay, so you lose fluids. The way to help somebody is to give them fluids. Now, sometimes when somebody is in heart failure, over here, their heart is getting weaker and weaker and weaker, and this could be due to high blood pressure when somebody's kidneys are failing, for instance. In this condition over here, a person's blood volume is too great. You have too much blood returning to the heart. And what happens to the heart then? It stretches out much too much, puts a person into heart failure. Sometimes we might want to call this congestive heart failure. Now, how could we help somebody over here, kind of magically? What would we want to do? We would want to decrease their end diastolic volume. And if we were to decrease their end diastolic volume, what would happen? Their contractility would go up. How can you decrease somebody's end diastolic volume? How about by giving a diuretic? Okay, just by giving somebody a diuretic, right, they pee that fluid out of their body. That reduces blood volume, that brings their end diastolic volume back to normal, and guess magically what happens to their heart? It gets stronger as a result of that. Okay, so knowing this intrinsic mechanism of the heart, Frank Starling law, is a really important way to think about cardiac function. Okay, now what about extrinsic control of the heart? We talked about that a little bit, right? So at any given end diastolic volume, contraction depends on the level of sympathoadrenal activity. Sometimes I call that sympathetic tone, just the amount of sympathetic activity. But don't forget, there's also the adrenal gland that can release epinephrine and norepinephrine in the blood, right? Norepinephrine and epinephrine produce an increase in heart rate and contraction. So increase in heart rate would be a positive what kind of event? What kind of control? Positive chronotropy, right? Positive because it's increasing the heart rate. But sympathetic tone, increasing sympathetic tone will increase force of contraction. That's a positive inotropic effect on the heart, right? So it's going to increase both the chronotropy and inotropy of the heart because there's going to be an increase of calcium in the sarcomeres, and so you're going to have more cross-bridge cycling, right? So, for instance, here is a plot of relative tension versus length of a muscle, and you can kind of relate this to end diastolic volume again, right, just by stretching the heart muscle. All right, so without sympathetic tone, the cardiac muscle, you see, has to stretch quite a bit. Let's just say 80%. Let's just pick 80%. And what kind of relative tension is that heart muscle going to produce? Oh, less than 10%, maybe 5%. But at that same muscle length at 80% with sympathetic stimulation, what kind of contraction do we get? A little bit at an angle. Let's say it goes from 5 to 40%, right, with the same level of stretch. All right, so things from outside the heart, namely sympathetic stimulation, will increase the force of contraction of the heart. That's an extrinsic mechanism, as opposed to the Frank Starling law due to the geometry of sarcomeres. That's an intrinsic mechanism of the heart that's going to help adjust the heart rate. Okay, and then this graph right here, which I'm not going to talk about, is just for your own information what that length tension relationship is for skeletal muscle. All right, and for skeletal muscle, we already showed that as the length of the muscle stretches, the force of contraction increases, because what can you tell me about the structural and functional unit of skeletal muscle? It's also a sarcomere, and you got to have the proper overlap of actin and myosin in order for it to function. Okay, so cardiac output is due to, or is directly related to cardiac rate or heart rate times stroke volume. And what's the effect of parasympathetic stimulation? Where do parasympathetic nerves go to? This is just a little anatomy. Only goes to the nodal tissues like the SA node and the AV node, but parasympathetic nerves don't go to the ventricular muscles at all, or the atrial muscles. So parasympathetic nervous system cannot affect stroke volume, can only affect heart rate. So parasympathetic only has chronotropic effects. Now, what about sympathetic stimulation? Sympathetic nerves go both to the nodal tissues as well as to the myocardium. So sympathetic, increasing sympathetic tone will increase heart rate, will also increase force of contraction, which is going to increase the stroke volume of the heart. All right, and then here is that intrinsic property of the heart. Changing end-diastolic volume, or the stretch of the heart, is going to increase the strength of contraction, that's going to increase stroke volume. Okay, so that's how to think about some of these parameters in terms of adjusting cardiac output. All right, now what is cardiac output? I probably didn't mention this. Cardiac output is really what? Blood flow. Volume per time, milliliters per minute. Okay, which means, for instance, how much oxygen can be delivered to your tissues is determined by that blood flow. All right, so how can venous return affect cardiac output? All right, so venous return is return of blood to the heart via veins. All right, that's venous return. And it controls the end-diastolic volume. So if there's more venous return, what happens to end-diastolic volume? It goes up. And as end-diastolic volume increases in a normal heart, what happens to the contractility of the heart? It goes up as well, because it's directly related. Okay. So end-diastolic volume is dependent on a couple of things, blood volume and venous pressure. Right? If you lose blood volume, like in that hemorrhage case, then your end-diastolic volume is going to go down. Vasoconstriction caused by sympathetic tone. So veins are very compliant kinds of blood vessels, all right, as opposed to arteries. Arteries pretty much have the same shape all the time, and they can't change their radius or diameter, but veins can expand quite a bit, which means a lot of blood can pool in a vein, and that sort of takes it out of the cardiovascular system. If it sits in a vein, it doesn't go around the circulatory system. So how could you get that blood out of a vein and put it into the cardiovascular system so it circulates? You could squeeze down on a vein, okay, and just push all that blood so that it doesn't pool in a vein. We call that vasoconstriction. When smooth muscles of veins contract, that decreases the volume of veins and that blood goes into the circulatory system and it starts to circulate. That's almost like giving somebody an IV. Okay, that increases blood volume. So what is the effect of vasoconstriction or venoconstriction? It's going to increase blood volume. It's going to increase the stretch of the heart. That's going to make the heart beat more strongly. That's going to increase stroke volume. Okay. Venous return also depends on two other kinds of pumps. in your body, and I think we talked about these in anatomy, but don't forget, in order for blood to flow from one place to another, there has to be a pressure difference, right? Blood can only flow from high pressure to low pressure. And pressure in veins is very, very low. So generally speaking, blood doesn't like to flow very fast or very far in a vein because there isn't very much pressure in it. But when you contract a muscle, right, when you contract, for instance, like a biceps muscle, what can you tell me about the pressure in those veins that are in that biceps? All of a sudden, the pressure goes way up when you contract that muscle, and the blood is going to squirt out of the biceps. But which way can it squirt? It can only squirt in one direction. Why is that? Because the structure of veins is that the endothelium has valves in it, right? And valves only allow blood to flow in one direction. So when a vein gets pressurized, blood squirts back up to the heart. It can't squirt back down to the periphery as a result of that. So when skeletal muscles contract, it sort of acts like a little heart. It's pumping blood from veins back up to the heart because veins have valves in them. The second kind of pump is what we call the respiratory pump, and that's due to intrathoracic pressure changes during inhalation. So remember that fluid can only flow from high pressure to low, and air is a fluid. Air flows into your lungs. So what does that mean? Why does fluid flow into your lungs, or why does air flow into your lungs? It can only flow from high pressure to low, so there has to be a mechanism for you to decrease the pressure inside your lungs, and the way you do that is by expanding your rib cage, depressing your diaphragm. That increases the volume of your thoracic cavity, and when that volume decreases, the pressure drops and air flows into your thoracic cavity as a result of that. Maybe. I don't know what the ratio necessarily is, but yeah, you have to match your breathing to match your activity level and the amount of oxygen that your body is using. Okay, so it's the amount of oxygen that your body is using. And of course, when you start to exercise, those mitochondria need more oxygen to make more ATP for cross-bridge cycling, and then those cells produce a lot of CO2, and that's going to be a stimulus for inspiration when CO2 goes up. And so you'll breathe deeper, you'll take a deeper breath, more air will flow into your lungs, and you'll get more oxygen that way. So your breathing will be matched to what the needs of your body are. Okay, so if you're breathing very shallowly, then maybe every once in a while you have to take a deeper breath just to get the right amount of air inside your lungs. Okay, so that's what we call the respiratory pump. Because as you expand your rib cage, your thoracic volume, that decreases the pressure in your chest. Not only does air flow into your chest, but since the pressure is low in your chest, that means that all the veins in your chest have very low pressure that helps suck blood through the venous system back into your thoracic cavity, which will return it back to the heart. So that's what we call the respiratory pump. So end-diastolic volume is going to control what? The contractility of the heart, because that adjusts the stretch. That's going to be determined by venous return. So how can your body adjust venous return? By adjusting the blood volume. So your body can increase or decrease blood volume by increasing or decreasing the amount of fluid that you lose through urination. What's the organ here that's controlling urine formation? That's your kidney. Okay, so your kidneys directly influence blood pressure and how your heart works by adjusting venous return. All right, so if your blood pressure is decreasing, your kidneys will produce less urine, will increase blood volume, that's going to increase venous return, that's going to increase diastolic volume, and that's going to increase contractility of the heart to bring blood pressure back up. Okay. Breathing also increases venous return because that sucks blood into your thoracic cavity. And also venous pressure, sympathetic stimulation causes constrictions of veins, right? And that forces blood back into the circulatory system, that increases blood volume, that increases venous return. And also by exercising muscles will help venous return as well. And for instance, you might have heard of some pathology associated with this. When veins are dilated, okay, and when skeletal muscle isn't contracting, blood will have a tendency to pool in veins. All right, so blood will collect in veins. And what's one of the dangerous conditions when if you have blood that's not flowing, if it's just sitting stationary? Guess what blood likes to do? It likes to clot, right? But it's still in your circulatory system if you're not exercising. So your circulatory system is generating these blood clots. And if you have a clot in your leg, okay, because you're not exercising, where's that clot going to move to? It's going to go into the inferior vena cava and then into the right atrium. That's not such a big deal. It can go into the right ventricle because these are all big vessels, right? Vessels get bigger and bigger as they go from small veins all the way to your heart. A clot's not going to get trapped anywhere. But after the right ventricle, where is it going to go? Pulmonary trunk. Now what happens to the size of those blood vessels? The pulmonary trunk bifurcates into the right and left, which means that what? It gets smaller, right? And then the pulmonary arteries get smaller and smaller and smaller as they form capillaries in your lungs, and that's where that blood clot then gets trapped. That forms a pulmonary embolism, and that's going to kill a part of the lung, okay? And that happened to a news reporter in one of the wars in Iraq. He didn't want to get out of his armored vehicle because everybody's trying to blow him up, right? So he just sat in his armored vehicle for about a week and a half, didn't exercise, and his body started to develop clots because he wasn't exercising, and one of those clots went to his lungs and caused a pulmonary embolism, and they couldn't save his life. It was too massive. I forget the name of that reporter. It was a pretty famous reporter. Does anybody recall who I'm talking about? No, not anybody, but I don't remember his name either. Unfortunate, okay? But I have even heard of people that are traveling faraway places on airplanes, maybe if they're on a 10 or 16-hour airplane flight, getting pulmonary embolisms because they're not exercising their skeletal muscle pumps. They're not exercising, okay? So if you're going to fly to Indonesia or Bali or Hong Kong or someplace, you should probably always get up and what? Exercise. Or Australia, get up and exercise a little bit to increase the venous return, the circulation, to prevent those blood clots. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, you know, it's surprising, but that could save somebody's life. You know, it probably has. Yeah. How long is that flight? Is that a 12-hour flight, kind of? 14, yeah, okay. That's a long time to just be sitting still. Okay, so I'm not kidding you guys about this stuff. It's actually real and important. Okay, so that's venous return. So if we just look at the venous systems, right, veins hold most of the blood in the body, about 70%. So here we have just a chart that shows all the blood in your body. Lungs contain about 10%, the heart about maybe 10%, systemic arteries sort of 10% of your blood volume, capillaries really small, 4 or 5%, large veins, okay, and small veins and venules, you know, as much as 70% of your blood is contained in veins. So how is it easy to increase the blood to these various parts of your body? We could squeeze blood out of these veins by what? Constricting, by increasing sympathetic tone, for instance. So veins are what we call capacitance blood vessels because they can dilate tremendously, and then they can also constrict to return that blood to the circulatory system. All right, so these are what we call high compliance. That means that as pressure changes in a vein, the diameter of that blood vessel is going to change quite a bit as well. Okay. All right, so that's the importance of venous return. Venous return influences heart contractility because as the venous return increases, that stretches the heart, that makes the heart contract more strongly. All right, let's look at blood and body fluid volumes, so blood volumes. There are three important hormones that regulate blood volume, right? And blood volume is going to determine blood pressure, and it's controlled by these three hormones. You have antidiuretic hormone, you have aldosterone and atrionatriuretic hormone. And after we're done talking about this section, I want you to come back and answer this question. Which of the above hormones are synergistic to each other and which are antagonistic to each other? Do you think it would be a good idea to have any of these hormones acting antagonistically to each other? Yeah, absolutely, right? Because that's how your body gets precise control and balance. Okay, so let's talk about some of these hormones. Antidiuretic hormone, sometimes we call that vasopressin. Any kind of pressor agent is going to have the capacity to increase your blood pressure. That's what we call a pressor agent. So what does a diuretic do? Makes you pee, okay? And as you lose fluid volume, what happens to your blood volume? It decreases. That decreases venous return. What's going to happen to cardiac output as you decrease blood volume or venous return? It's going to decrease, and it's going to decrease your blood pressure, okay? Antidiuretic hormone is going to do the opposite thing, right? It's an antidiuretic, which means what? Are you going to lose fluids or retain fluids? You're going to retain fluids. Those fluids stay in your body. That increases venous return. Cardiac output is going to go up, and your blood pressure is going to go up as a result of that. Okay, so ADH, don't forget, is released by the posterior pituitary. The posterior pituitary has axons originating from cell bodies in the hypothalamus. And so the hypothalamus has osmoreceptors that detect high osmolality or high salt in the blood. All right, so, and that could be due to what? Drinking too many margaritas with salt, for instance, right? Increasing your salt intake or too many Fritos, right? Or from dehydration. Right? Maybe you're exercising too much and you're perspiring too much. So antidiuretic hormone is going to cause thirst. You're going to be thirsty. You want to drink water. Right? So what does that do? That's going to counteract the high saltiness of blood. But ADH is also going to stimulate water resorption from urine. That's happening, urine formation in the kidneys. So as you resorb water from urine and put it back into your body, right, then you just don't pee that water out. So let's take a look at this graph right here. So the initial stimulus is what? Dehydration or decreased blood volume or salt ingestion. That's going to increase blood osmolality, which is means what? That's just the saltiness of blood. That's going to stimulate osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is the integration center and makes a decision on what to do. It's going to send a signal to the posterior pituitary to release antidiuretic hormone. Antidiuretic hormone, since it's a hormone, travels by the blood to the kidneys, and it's going to cause water retention by the kidneys. So it's going to produce very small amounts of urine that are very concentrated in salt, highly concentrated, small volumes of urine. So since your body is retaining volume, what happens to blood volume? It increases, right? Your blood osmolality decreases. Right, so what is the relationship between this decreasing blood osmolality with this initial stimulus? All right, or let's take a look at blood volume. Increasing blood volume is the response. How does it relate to the initial stimulus? Does it add to it or subtract from it? Subtracts from it. So what kind of feedback is that? That's negative feedback. And what typically negative feedback maintains what? Maintains a normal, healthy state or homeostasis, right? So here's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, the hypothalamus, when the osmoreceptors are stimulated, also gives you the sensation of thirst, and you quench your thirst by drinking, okay? Hopefully not more margaritas, but that's going to increase your blood volume, okay? And again, that's a nice negative feedback mechanism that subtracts from the initial stimulus, all right? And as your blood volume goes back to normal, that's going to increase your blood pressure. Okay, so ADH increases blood volume, increases blood pressure. All right, let's look at aldosterone. Aldosterone, another hormone. Okay, and you know where it's secreted from. It's a steroid hormone, so what can you tell me about its receptors? Just as a blast from the past. Where are the receptors for aldosterone located? They're inside the cell someplace, right? They're either cytoplasmic or nuclear receptors, because aldosterone can enter the cells right through the plasma membrane, and it's secreted by what gland? The the adrenal cortex. That's right, because the adrenal medulla releases norepinephrine and epinephrine. All right, and aldosterone helps maintain blood volume and thus blood pressure. through reabsorption and retention of both salt and water from the urine that's being produced by the kidney. And if you reabsorb salt and water, it's taken from urine and put where? Back into your body. That increases blood volume, that increases venous return, that increases end-diastolic volume, that has a tendency to maintain or increase blood pressure. All right, so the release of aldosterone from the adrenal cortex is stimulated by salt deprivation, not drinking enough margaritas, so it's always a question of balance, right? Salt deprivation, or if you're dehydrated, that produces low blood volume, but also low blood pressure can stimulate the release of aldosterone. So let's take a look at how that happens. It's the result of this mechanism right here, which we call the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system or mechanism. Okay? And this is the system that's the most important system, can't emphasize this enough, the most important system for regulating blood pressure in the long term, from week to week and month to month, but not second to second. This system won't work when you stand up, for instance, after you've been sitting listening to a lecture all day long. But this is what's going to help maintain your blood pressure on a week-to-week's basis. And do you know any pathologies associated with blood pressure? You know any, like high blood pressure, what do we call that? That is hypertension, right? And we believe, a lot of times we don't know exactly why somebody has hypertension, but we believe that there is something that's not happening properly in the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism that's producing hypertension in people, right? And as a matter of fact, by understanding the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, that will tell us how to help treat somebody that has hypertension by knowing these various steps in this mechanism right here. All right, so when there's a salt, so got to pay attention to this one, bottom line is what I'm trying to say, okay? So a lot of times students would say, well, this is the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, but it's not too bad, okay? We'll just go through it a couple times. All right, so when there's salt deficit or low blood volume or low blood pressure, angiotensin II is produced. That's a hormone. Angiotensin II causes a number of effects, all aimed at increasing blood pressure, to get your blood pressure back up to where it should be. It causes vasoconstriction. That increases blood pressure. So, for instance, if you have a balloon and you squeeze down on the balloon, what happens to the pressure of air inside that balloon? Does it go down or does it go up or does it stay the same? It goes up. As a matter of fact, it goes up so much that what might happen to the balloon? It might pop, right? And that could happen to, for instance, a blood vessel in us if the blood pressure goes too high. All right. Angiotensin II causes the release of aldosterone secretion. So angiotensin II causes aldosterone secretion, and angiotensin II also makes you thirsty, kind of like what hormone that we talked about? ADH, right? So when you drink, that increases your blood volume, and that's going to increase your blood pressure. Another way of thinking about how blood volume increases blood pressure, it works by increasing venous return, but it also works by another mechanism. All right, if you walk out to your car after school and you see you have a flat tire, which means what do you have to do to the pressure inside that tire? Do you want to increase it or decrease it? You need to increase the pressure in that tire. Now, how do you increase the pressure inside that tire? Do you put air in or take air out? You got to put air in. Same thing for your cardiovascular system. When your blood pressure is too low, what do you do? Put fluid in. When your blood pressure is too high, your body should take fluid out, okay, and adjust the pressure inside your body. And that can be done through this system right here. All right. So here is the whole system, okay? Here is a flow diagram. So the initial stimulus is going to be a decrease in blood pressure and or decreased blood flow to the kidneys. So again, your kidneys are involved in this system. When there's a decreased blood pressure or flow through the kidneys, there's a special part of the kidney called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. This is, remember your anatomy, the functional unit of the kidney is the nephron. And there's an afferent and efferent arteriole going right into the glomerulus. And right at that junction, you have the juxtaglomerular apparatus that can measure the salt concentration of blood and blood pressure and oxygen concentration. That's the juxtaglomerular apparatus. So when blood pressure decreases, that juxtaglomerular apparatus releases renin. And renin goes into the blood, but it's not a hormone. Renin is an enzyme. So what does an enzyme do? It speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction, so it speeds up the rate of conversion of angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1. What can you tell me about angiotensinogen? Was that a trick question on the last test, or did I forget to put it? I forgot to put it on there. Okay. What can you tell me about angiotensinogen? It's inactive because it has a suffix ogen on it. Even though you've never heard of it before, you know it's inactive. But renin can activate it. So this compound from the kidney can activate angiotensinogen. It converts it into angiotensin 1. Angiotensin 1 is not particularly potent or useful in your body. It has to be converted into another compound, which is called angiotensin 2. So angiotensin 1 gets converted into angiotensin 2. And this happens, and you should probably write this in your notes, this happens in the lung. So 1 goes to 2 in the lung. And again, what speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction? An enzyme. And so the enzyme that converts 1 to 2 is called angiotensin converting enzyme. So instead of saying angiotensin converting enzyme all the time, what are we going to say? We're going to say ACE, right? That's an enzyme. Where does that enzyme hang out? In the lung, right? It's going to be in other places in your body, but mostly in the lung. All right, so here's that angiotensin 2. It has a number of effects. Let's look at the simplest one first. Angiotensin 2 is going to cause vasoconstriction of arterioles. And as you vasoconstrict, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up, all right? So that increased blood pressure, how does that relate to the initial stimulus? Subtracts from it in a negative way, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. Angiotensin 2 does other effects, like namely, since it's a hormone, travels by the blood to the adrenal cortex, and it tells the adrenal cortex to release aldosterone. Now, how does the adrenal cortex know to release aldosterone when angiotensin is there? What does the adrenal cortex have to have? How does it know to listen to that particular molecule? How does it know that molecule is there? Because there's got to be a receptor for angiotensin 2 in the adrenal cortex. Right, and the shape of angiotensin 2 is different than angiotensin 1, so the adrenal cortex is kind of blind to angiotensin 1. Doesn't even know it's there because there's no angiotensin 1 receptor. Right? All right, so angiotensin 2 binds to the receptor in the adrenal cortex. The adrenal cortex then releases aldosterone, and then aldosterone is a hormone that goes in the blood, and it ends up binding to receptors in the kidney. Right, and don't forget that's a steroid hormone. Those receptors are inside the cells of the kidney. And that's going to cause kidneys to resorb both salt and water, put it back into the circulatory system. That increases blood volume. And as you increase blood volume, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up, right? And that subtracts from the initial stimulus right here. Okay, so here is the whole renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. And it all works to what? Maintain or to boost your blood pressure. And that's the most important mechanism from week to week in your body for maintaining blood pressure. But this is something that we believe that's not working in somebody that has hypertension. So how can we help somebody with hypertension? And should we help somebody with hypertension? What's the end result of hypertension? Well, yeah, it's going to cause cardiovascular disease. It's going to kill the heart. It's going to kill blood vessels. It's going to kill kidneys. And are kidneys important for regulating blood pressure? Yeah, so you see some of these things are synergistic with each other, right? So you have to treat hypertension. You don't feel bad when you have hypertension. You actually feel pretty good. So you really need to get your blood pressure checked. That's probably one of the most important clinical exams that's done for people every single day. Who's had their blood pressure checked in here ever? Anybody? Yeah, hopefully everybody, right? Even when you go see a dentist. Right? Dentists now check blood pressure for people because it's such a deadly disease. So how can you reduce somebody's blood pressure? Okay, well, if this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system is causing salt and water retention by the kidneys, what could you give somebody? A diuretic, right, to reduce their blood volume. That does a pretty nice job. All right, there's other things, though, that happen. When you give somebody diuretics, all right, and that reduces blood pressure, then this system might get more sensitive and release more aldosterone, which is going to try to counteract the effect of that diuretic. So a lot of times when somebody has hypertension, they can't just take one pharmaceutical agent. They have to take two, maybe three, in order to bring their blood pressure back down. So what are some other things we can do? How about if we block the conversion of angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2? That's going to block this system. That's going to block increasing blood volume and increasing blood pressure. So if we block that ACE, the angiotensin converting enzyme, that might have a tendency to decrease somebody's blood pressure too. And those are what we call ACE inhibitors. Those are actually very nice drugs that work, okay, along with diuretics. How else could we help somebody with hypertension? How about if we block the effect of aldosterone? Where does aldosterone work? What's the organ that has a receptor for aldosterone? It's the kidney, right? And somebody found and designed or somehow came up with a receptor blocker for angiotensin on the adrenal cortex right here. So if they take that drug, okay, it's called an ARB. That's an angiotensin 2 receptor blocker, right? So along with an ACE, along with a diuretic, that's really going to reduce somebody's blood pressure very nicely, okay? So angiotensin receptor blockers. And then some other agents right here will work very nicely, and they don't directly interface with the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, but a beta blocker. What can a beta blocker do? What kind of receptor is a beta receptor? For what kind of signal is going to be sensitive to a beta? What class of receptor is a beta receptor? It's an adrenergic receptor for epinephrine and norepinephrine. And where do you have beta 1 receptors? In your heart, right? If you stimulate a beta 1, that's going to increase the force of contraction of the heart. But if you block that, the heart is going to slow down. It's not going to contract as strongly, and blood pressure will come down as a result. So you can use beta blockers, yeah?
How do you know if the person you put up with all the solutions, but how do you know if the person's suffering from what? How do you test that?
You know, we don't know how to test which component is misbehaving in somebody with hypertension. Yeah, maybe all of these are just kind of misset, and we just don't know. And I think we call that idiopathic hypertension. Somebody has hypertension but don't know the cause, and that's mostly what happens in people. We don't really know what the cause is, okay? But I can give you some hints on how to help that a little bit besides pharmaceuticals. All right, these beta blockers not only decrease the force of contraction of the heart, but they have a tendency to dilate blood vessels. And as you dilate a blood vessel, the pressure decreases. So it has another beneficial effect. What about calcium channel blockers? What does a heart need to contract? It needs calcium. And if you block those calcium channels, what happens to the activity of the heart? It gets less vigorous, and the same thing for smooth muscle around blood vessels. Right? They won't contract as much. That will have a tendency to decrease blood pressure. And then we never talked about alpha-2 agonists or alpha-2 receptors in the central nervous system. These are adrenergic receptors. All right, but they have a tendency to vasodilate blood vessels. That's going to decrease blood pressure. And an example of a very potent alpha-2 agonist would be clonidine. So if somebody comes into a clinic with really high blood pressure, dangerous high blood pressure, so that at any second somebody could actually blow a blood vessel up in their brain or heart, okay, maybe their blood pressure is 210 over 150, all right, what do you want to do to their blood pressure? Get it down fast before they blow up, right? So clonidine would be something you would use, and it would work, you know, probably in a half hour or something. But you could probably imagine how you would feel if your blood pressure changed that drastically over a very short period of time. Okay? You might not be able to function very well, but at least your brain isn't going to explode, right? So that's a really good thing. Perfect trade-off. So here are some things that you can use to help treat somebody with hypertension because the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system isn't behaving quite correctly. And then here's just a little link to WebMD that you can go look around and find out the names of some of these agents if you're interested to find out what some good treatments might be. Okay, one last hormone that we can talk about, and that's atrial natriuretic hormone. Guess where atrial natriuretic hormone comes from? The atrium of the heart. That's right. So it comes from the heart. All right. So as venous return comes back to the heart and it stretches the atrium, right, that expanded blood volume is detected by stretch receptors in the left atrium. As venous blood returns to the heart, the atria stretch. There are stretch receptors, and as those stretch receptors stretch, that causes the release of atrial natriuretic hormone. That's a hormone. It goes into the blood, and atrial natriuretic hormone inhibits aldosterone. So you can see it's what? Synergistic or antagonistic to aldosterone. It's going to be antagonistic to aldosterone because it inhibits it. Atrial natriuretic hormone promotes both salt and water excretion in the urine. All right, so you're going to be producing lots of urine when that happens, and that lowers blood volume. As you lower blood volume, what happens to stroke volume of the heart? It decreases, and as stroke volume goes down, what happens to cardiac output? It goes down, your blood pressure then decreases as a result. All right, and atrial natriuretic hormone also produces or promotes vasodilation, and when you vasodilate, what happens to blood pressure? It goes down. All right, so think about just squeezing on a balloon. If you constrict on a balloon, pressure goes up. If you allow it to expand, the pressure goes down inside that balloon. All right, so here is a mechanism that shows atrial natriuretic hormone. All right, so if there's an increase in blood volume, more blood is returning to the heart. All right, so that means there's more stretch in the left atrium, then the left atrium is going to release AMP. AMP then has receptors in the kidney that increase salt and water excretion, so more salt and water is going to be excreted by the kidney. Right, so that increases urine volume, that decreases blood volume, and you can see that this is what, in opposition to the initial stimulus, so this is a nice negative feedback that's going to maintain blood pressure as a result. Okay, the stretch of the left atrium is also sending signals to the brain via the vagus nerve to the posterior pituitary, and to the hypothalamus, and then the hypothalamus to the posterior pituitary. And what hormone is released from the posterior pituitary that can adjust urine output? And that is antidiuretic hormone. So in this particular case, the brain decides, well, let's cut back on the secretion of antidiuretic hormone, because what I need is what? Really a diuretic effect. I need to get rid of fluids to maintain my fluid balance. So this decreases ADH, and that decreases resorption of water. That means more urine is formed, and that decreases blood volume, and that brings blood pressure back to the normal range. All right, so I think we're done for today. What about the sign-in sheet? Did I give you a sign-in sheet? Yeah, who's got it? Oh, it's down here. So don't forget, sign the sign-in sheet before you go if you need to. And all right, kind of look over this chapter a little bit, but next lecture will probably start making a whole lot more sense. Okay, hopefully. Okay.